Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of the Big Red Bus as we take the glorious monstrosity out onto the streets of Chicago. I look to my right, and lo and behold, it's the great one, Doug Tonis. How you doing,
bro? I am living the dream. We're right about the start of training camp, almost. We'll have media day soon. It's amazing how compressed all of that timeline is now, too, right? Like, it's you're going to have, like, preseason games in, what, like a week and a half or so? I mean, it's pretty good.
It's awesome. I can't wait. I don't know if you agree with this. The offseason, for whatever reason, this year was, like, a year long. I don't know. It just seemed just unending to me and just a lot of drama. I'm just glad we're finally going to have some basketball to talk about, and I'm thrilled. Before we get started, though, I did want to – story time? Can we do a quick story time?
Yeah, why not?
Because it's relevant to this season. It's absolutely 100% relevant to what we're going to be talking about.
I never know where this is going.
You remember my band that had that horrific ending at the hand of some little people wrestlers back in the day?
One of my favorite all-time stories, but okay, yeah.
Okay, great. I don't want to go into that again, and if anyone wants to hear that story, you can go back and find it. I'm sure it's somewhere on the internet. But my nephew got married this past Sunday.
Okay.
Congrats to O for getting married. And while I was there, I ran into the other guitar player, my good friend, longtime friend, Pat Kiner, who I haven't had a chance to chat with for a while. But he was there along with family and friends, and we started reminiscing about that evening. And I forgot how horrific some of the details were, some key details. And I started thinking and comparing it to the Bulls season. So a little bit of background. The one part which I neglected to remember for about 15, 20 years, or I chosen to forgot, blocked it out, was while we were getting set up. So we walk in and there's, you know, actual rings there. We're all mortified. You bring up your amp, you plug it in, and you every time you do a sound check. So you kind of like get the levels right. And when we did sound checks, I would play like Red Hot Chili Peppers. Those were one of my favorite bands at the time. I think I was playing Californication, which was one of my favorite songs. So people who had no idea what the band would do would have just assumed that that's the type of music we'd be playing. But obviously we're a 50s and 60s band. So I forgot this part, that I was playing the Chili Peppers song to get the levels. And when I walked off the stage, this guy comes up to me and just says, "Chili Peppers suck. You know, they're for a word that has to do with cats." You know what I'm getting at. It's a P word. Yeah, I just want to save it for the kids out there. Anyhow, and he's like, "You guys going to do Korn or are you going to do some Limp Bizkit, right?" And I'm like, I hate those bands. Do you remember those bands, how big they were, like right around 2000? They were absolutely huge. You know what I'm talking about?
Korn, Limp Bizkit. You remember those bands? Limp Bizkit, yes.
And you know how much they sucked and how horrible they were, and everyone who listened to them were a bunch of meatheads. Well, that's exactly what this guy was like. And, you know, I was like, "Korn sucks. Limp Bizkit sucks. We're not doing any of it, you know, blah, blah, blah." And he goes off. This guy goes off and says, you know, he's, "I'm going to punch you in the face." So before the show, the battle with the little people even started, I've got a member of the audience threatening me, saying that during the show, he's going to throw a beer bottle at me, all this stuff. I'm going to jump on stage, beat your ass. So I already had a whole level of threat before we actually played.
So I just want to be clear. Before a show where you're about to go on stage, you thought it would be a brilliant idea to pick a fight with a fan for no reason.
How did I pick
well,
the fight?
Well, because
I'm
like
playing
he's like,
Chili Peppers song.
I walk off stage and he says, you're not going to play that shit. The fan's a jerk. I get it.
Yes.
But then you're like, "Hey, you know what? Your music sucks. I ain't playing any of it." Like, I mean, it's like, fine. I get that he was inappropriate. But like, what made you think, you know, what a great idea would be is right before I go on stage to piss off this guy? And the funny thing about this is, you know, he's into Korn and Limp Bizkit, and you're going to play 60s and 70s music. So you can take a guess at how that's going to go.
Right there, there's a problem.
Like, you know, that's going to anyway. Okay. So you picked a fight with a metalhead before the show.
Yes. And he wasn't a metalhead. He was just like a 22-year-old dope.
Frat
guy, whatever. Just sitting there, you know, talking smack to me. And then I realized, though, but it did cause another level of, like, anxiety. And it did cause another level of worry. So not only do we not do Chili Peppers, so you should have seen the look on his face. So, you know, Chili Peppers, he thought, were for the P word. We open up with Surfing USA by the Beach Boys, which is – Which is a whole another level of
I imagine, not this guy's vibe. Not this guy's vibe.
Exactly. Not this guy's cup of tea. And so obviously, you knew what happened. Everybody knows the story, knows what happens after that. And it's a horrific scene with fisticuffs and anger and embarrassment. That said, so why do I bring this up? I bring this up because I had totally forgotten about that whole pre-show incident. And all the anxiety I had during those first few songs over this dude and his idiot buddies, because later on I was, beat in front of my family by a little person wrestler. You forget terrible times are actually often worse than you actually remember them as. And I'm bringing this up because I was thinking about this the other day about the, full rebuild. Somebody had mentioned to me, well, you seem to be fine with doing a full rebuild. And I think people forget how bad those days are. And I think this guy was right. I think he's right. Like, we forget Mark Kay waxing poetic about Wayne Selden and all these horrible losses and games that no one cares about. Maybe this is the better option for us to try to kind of walk this line of winning 25 games or taking a minor step back this year with some young players with experience and trying to shorten that period of a full rebuild. What say you?
I would say that analytically, there is a few things you can try to do, and none of them are likely to work, and they have different pros and cons. And so, if you bear with me for a moment, the full rebuild.
Do you like that intro, though?
Yeah, I think that's a nice way to get around there. And plus, it's just a great story. And there's going to be people who don't know the story, and now you're going to have to explain it on Twitter or go find it.
Okay.
If you do a full rebuild, I think we go back a year or two ago, Fred. You remember I had a plan, which was like trade Zach, Vooch, and DeMar at the peak of their value. This was after the 46-win season. And at the time, we agreed, and I think Alex Caruso as well, that you could get 5 to 6 first-round draft picks for those four guys at that point in time. And then you would rebuild around this younger group, which, hey, we're doing now anyway, except without the extra six first-round draft picks. So if we could go back in time, we probably would have preferred to do what we're already doing with 6 extra draft picks. But we can't. But the point of that is, if you want to do a full rebuild, you can't just try to be bad. And I think that's where people like mistake. You can't be bad. The lottery odds are too lousy. You got to start using your cap space to get extra picks. You got to trade guys who are good but not great for extra picks. Like, if you want to go that route, your move is to trade Kobe and Io because they're the guys who can probably get you really good value right now. And you just need to get lots of picks. You need lots of tries. And so that, and then you'll also be like really terrible and you wouldn't have extended Pat. You'd have traded him. Like, you really go full into it. And you don't just try and be like, well, I was really bad and I hope my one pick turns out. You want to be picking like 3 times every draft in the first round. And, so if you're going to do full rebuild, that's the way you have to do it. And then, you're going to win like 15 games and your team's going to suck. And there's not going to be a single player on it that's going to be on it 2 years from now. And that's terrible. But the hope is by getting all these picks, you make something happen. So that's like option number one. And that option is a lot more palatable if you had played it when you already had guys like Kobe and Io on the roster and you're getting all those extra picks from like older guys like Zach and DeMar and Vooch who weren't going to be here in the future. It's a lot less palatable than it is today. I think we'd agree with that. The other plan is kind of what you're talking about, which is like, well, our hope now is we're going to try and get a bunch of good young talent. We're going to hope, we can float around, say, mid-30s. Like, this is mid-30s talent. Maybe it's talent that could get back up to 40 wins, kind of with what we have. And we're going to dip down 1 year, and maybe we get really lucky, and we win the lottery from the 7th spot, 6th spot, and we draft Cooper Flagg, and now we've got a star. And then we still have these like other young pieces around him, and then we can make something happen. And so if you were to compare like plans like this, they're both really unlikely to succeed, right, in the grand scheme of things. But, this plan, you're not in quite as bad of shape, but you also have lower odds. You're like hoping that this one magic thing happens and you only got one shot at it. And the odds aren't that good. And then if it happens, maybe now you're like a upper 40s team, low 50s team if lag develops, and then you got to figure out how to make the next step later, but at least you have kind of that core stuff in place. And so like the odds of eventually finding a star, if you have like many picks in the draft each year, are higher than what we're going to do. But then once you find that star with all those other picks, unless you hit on all the other guys at the same time and you get like good role players with them, you're also so far away, right? Like we're not going to be so far away if we get lucky. And so it's kind of like the odds of getting the star are much lower, but the like build back up if we get one is much easier. And like that's kind of the trade-off that you have between those two fundamental theories. And then there's ways you want to try to maximize either of those theories. And, you know, one of the real problems is I don't think we're good at doing either of those things. Like we clearly, when we've wanted to be bad, we weren't maximizing the odds of being bad. But when we're trying to do this dip down plan, you know, we also sort of skate in the middle. We sign some of these, like we overpay everyone by a few million dollars. Like we're buying like the leather interior for the car before we have the engine. You know, trying to get a high-end stereo in place before the transmission's there. You know, we don't know if we have four wheels yet, but we're gonna get the moonroof in. So, you know, we're overpaying for like we're paying role players like luxury salaries often while we don't have the other things in place, and that's gonna make it really hard if we do get a player to keep everything together salary-wise. So, I think in the end, like either of those approaches can be good or can work for you. And I'm going to use an example of the Thunder is a team that basically used the get a ton of extra picks, use the picks, and then now you figure out a way to make it work. You got enough hits. And then I'm going to use the Denver Nuggets as a team that was like, hey, we never got like so terrible, but we got our superstar by blind luck in the second round. And, you know, we had all these other good pieces. You know, like once they were there, it's like, all right, Jamal Murray was there. He's a lottery pick, but he wasn't like number one overall. And he's still not what you would probably think is a real superstar in the NBA. And then you got like a bunch of good role players that you moved in and out over the years by kind of drafting well. And so like either of those things can work. I don't think like you have to do one or the other. It's just like what has to happen to win a championship and how much luck do you need? It's pretty high in both scenarios. What's the downside in each scenario? And then how well do you execute? And our real problem is, like, I don't trust our current front office to execute either plan well. And that's maybe, like, the greater problem is I just don't think our guys are really good. Gar Pax was actually an example of, like, kind of executing that plan. Like, you think we got lucky one time in their era. We got Derrick Rose. We won the most games in the league, you know, 3 years after we drafted him. We were in the playoffs right away. And why was that? Because we had a bunch of like talent on the team already. And, you know, they were consistently good at like keeping talent, cycling it out, moving it before it got too old. Like, you know, traded James Johnson for a pick, Tyrus for a pick, Mirotic for a pick, Thabo for a pick. You dump Teague and you still got something back for him, even if it was ridiculously little. Dump McDermott and you still got campaign. Like they didn't commit to guys like, oh, well, we drafted this guy and now we're just stuck with him forever, like Patrick Williams. You know, so it's like they're willing to just move off guys like perpetually and you know, kind of keep this baseline of like average talent. And people made fun of them all the time for that, right? Like it was like, oh, well, just, you know, we're first round exit team. But they had, I think it was like 12 of 14 years in a row they made the playoffs, like 12 out of 14 years. And so it's like they were always average.
I think from 2010 to 2017, the Bulls had the second most wins in the NBA.
Yeah, could be
outside of the Dallas. I mean, that's a pretty long stretch.
Could be true. So anyway,
there's no doubt they drafted.
So they, you know, but they did good. But like the point is, like they always kept this kind of. And then when the one time they finally got lucky, they had a championship window up until Derrick Rose tore his ACL. And so like they, you know, that was a team that even though I think, you know, you know, we both believe probably those guys were underappreciated and how good they were at their job and maybe a little bit unfairly despised. I get at the end, it went really poorly for them. Maybe the game passed them by, not suggesting we have them back. But like that was like they executed for a very long time. They executed that strategy really, really well. And in the end, I don't trust AK to execute any strategy well.
I would concur. Like, I do feel that, you know, Acme has done some decent things. Like, the signing of Caruso is one of the best free agent signings in Bulls history. But you still look at that and you're like, all the Lakers had to do was match it. We weren't the first choice. You know, that could have easily been taken away. But that said, you deserve credit for making it happen. Patrick Williams draft pick under any evaluation right now was a mistake compared to some of the talent that was still available. You know, they drafted Iowa. That was a good move. Really good move. Nice draft pick. But then again, I'm sitting at home on my couch screaming for them to take him. So
yeah, for 10 picks, you're just begging Iowa falls to us, right? Like, we started rooting for Iowa when he was on the board at like 30, and I think we drafted 37, if memory serves me correctly, that year.
I wanted him to trade up for him.
He's
still available at 25. Trade up. What are you doing?
Well, it's a good move. Good move. We give them credit. A bunch of other teams didn't do it, right? And they could have been another team that passed, and they didn't. They could have taken Mini Cooper, as our buddy Mark K would have done. But they didn't. So, you give them credit for it. Like I said, the thing is with any general manager, whether they're good or bad, like, they make a lot of transactions. They're going to make some good stuff. They're going to make some bad stuff happen. What bothers me is a lot of the strategy. You know, like, you're a low 30s win team and you trade multiple draft picks for Nikola Vucevic and a lottery, you know, former lottery pick that's already shown starting caliber performance just with injuries for Nikola Vucevic and bad salary. Like, who does that? Like, who thinks at 32, 33 wins, whatever that was we had, this is the time to trade multiple draft picks and a young player at the same position who's already shown starting capability for a center who's like, 30, 31, whatever he was when we traded for him. Like, it's just like a nonsensical thing to do. And, you know, then it's like, we should do it. We should pair DeMar into this situation. We need a third, like, volume scorer, you know, that doesn't play defense. You know, and people are like, well, if Lonzo was here, we'd have tied it all together. Like, if your whole plan hinged on a guy who averaged like 60% of the games played over his career, and you had no backup to that plan, what the hell were you thinking? You know, so it's just like they didn't like piece together anything cohesively. I think what they did is they were just like, all right, we need to separate ourselves from the last front office. Who is the most talented person that we can get on the market? Nikola Vucevic? All right, done. It's free agency. Who is the most talented person, you know, we can get? DeMar DeRozan, you know, for whatever oddball reason people aren't picking up on him, doesn't matter that this is a terrible fit, done. Like, they just were like, all right, let's try to just collect misfit pieces of talent and just hope it works. And, you know, like, there wasn't any cohesive strategy of how any of this could get better. Like, even to the extent that could have maybe worked better than it did if Lonzo stayed healthy, you had no way to improve that team, right? Because you had like good but not great players everywhere. And you had mostly those good players were kind of cast offs that were not super desired by other franchises, which is why they were available to us. Like, there was no way to take another step after that. And you used like three first round draft picks you traded into the future to get to that point, and you were capped out. So it's just like they didn't leave themselves any leeway for the next move to happen, even if what they did, which was had really low probability to work, even if it did work, they had no way to make the next thing work. And because some of those guys were older, it was like you knew it wasn't going to last real long. So, you know, I don't think they've made all misses. And, you know, look at the Iowa and Kobe contracts today. You feel really positive about those. Like, it's not like everything they do is a disaster, but I don't think they have any vision of how to cohesively do things. And when you hear AK talk, it like really stands out that he has no vision of how to do things, and the way he speaks about the game. Just he seems like a moron. He just seems like an absolute moron. And Eversley doesn't seem any better. Like, these guys just say dumb things like all of the time.
Yeah, I think to me, my biggest issue with them is like doubling down on mistakes. And, you know, that second contract, I understood the thinking behind getting Vucevic. I think they should have bargained better. You know, that said, you made the deal. I was fine with it at the time. You sign him again to a third year. It's like insanity. Patrick Williams' contract is he won't be ready before the start of the season. You signed an injured player to a deal that looks embarrassing when compared to players of a similar caliber. And Isaac Okoro signs for 12 or 13 million, and, you know, good player after good player signs for less money than Patrick Williams, who's got a fifth-year player option. It's absolutely ridiculous. Yeah. All these player options they've given out. Just to give an example about Craig, this will be a good segue into the next topic. I'm already seeing, like, even people I love Big Dave, I love those guys at CHGO, listen to Lockdown Bulls. All these guys are furious about Billy. They're blaming Billy. Oh my gosh, he's gonna play Craig more than he's gonna play Buzelis. And my counter to that is the memo from Arturas is we're gonna try to win every game. Well, if that's your memo from your GM, you're gonna try to win every game. Why are you upset at Billy when he's trying to execute the plan? Craig is the better shooter defender over a developing player like 19-year-old Buzelis. Is that true? Yes, that's true. The front office gave directions to win with Craig, and they gave him a player option. If you didn't want Craig to be competing with Buzelis, why did you give the player option to the player who ended up taking it? Now he's on the roster. That's on AK. That's not on Billy. The message is to win. Best answer for that is Craig, not Buzelis. Do you agree with me on this? Who's at fault?
I mean, I think that's pretty silly to say, like, why did you give Torrey Craig a player option on basically a 2-year minimum deal? Like, you probably had to get him to sign. And I think that was a good signing last year, like, for the value that he could potentially bring. So I think that's fine. And then you don't know you're going to draft Buzelis this year at the time you sign Craig. And the idea that, like, we got to be scared of signing Torrey Craig because now a guy we draft a year from now might play the same position and maybe Craig will play over him. Like, that's like an impossible foresight. Like, I just like AK, but like, I don't think, no, like, dude, you don't worry about signing a vet min guy and thinking like, oh, maybe the guy we draft won't play because we have this vet min guy.
I don't think the player option was needed to sign.
I think it was.
That's all I'm saying. Sure it wasn't in high demand.
I think for sure
and
it
was. And if he was in high demand, why did he pick up the player option?
I think last year he would have had more deals than ours at the vet minimum, and he would have gone to a better team than ours last year.
All right. Regardless of that fact, let's take that off the table. Are you upset if Billy plays Craig over?
No, you play to win the games. Like, at some point at the end of the season, then maybe we won't. But like, the coach is going to try to win. We're going to probably play Torrey Craig. Like, they'll probably try to get Buzelis some minutes, but Buzelis is going to be freaking awful at the beginning of the season.
I know.
Like, I don't know why people are like, oh, we got to play Buzelis. Buzelis is going to look like Dalen Terry at the beginning of the year. Like, it's not going to look good. So, yeah, I think it's fine that he doesn't play a ton of minutes right away. Like, he's a prospect. I want him to get some burn on the floor, but like, you know, if you're totally out of it, then I'm sure they'll be like, all right, now we're going to throw in the towel like everyone else. But they aren't going to enter the season trying to lose games. And you know, like, I know I talk sometimes about, like, I would either go all in on being bad or I do this or whatever, and I can be pretty extremist or whatever about stuff. But we're clearly not doing that, right? We're clearly not going into this season expecting to lose all the games. Like, they would love to make the playoffs this year if they could. And they're going to start off the year trying to do that. And I know, like, all the Bulls fans think there's no way that can happen. Like, if Zach LaVine comes back like a monster, why can't it? Why can't the Bulls win 40 games this year? Like,
I would say because their defense is going to be...
Their defense was going to be terrible every other year.
One of the worst in history of the league.
I don't know. Like, they lost Caruso, who only played like half the games anyway, and only played like half the minutes and half the games.
Played over 70 games last year.
Was it over 70? I believe you.
Yes.
It feels worse.
He was one of I think he was number one on the team in terms of on-off.
Yeah, no, so Caruso is great, but like,
great player.
He's also not playing like massive minutes. Like, I agree Caruso is going to make a difference, but like, Zach can come back and play really well. You're the one who thinks Kobe is going to be like a Hall of Fame caliber player this year. Like, if that happens...
I didn't say Hall of Fame, All-Star. Well,
whatever,
I'm not Hall of Fame.
Joking a little bit.
Being sarcastic.
I'm giving you a little bit of a hard time. But fine, if you think Kobe can be an all-star caliber player and Zach can be an all-star caliber player like he was 2 years ago, and if you get something out of Io in terms of improvement, like, I don't see why they can't like compete for the playoffs. You know, and I don't mean like I think that's going to be the outcome, but I mean, I think that's where they're going to start, right? At the beginning of the season, I don't think they're like, ah, we're screwed. We're going to win 25 games. Like, I agree with you that like this could go really badly quickly. And if it does go really badly, then I think you'll start seeing him being like, yeah, we're going to play Buzelis more instead of Craig. But But I think they're going to start. I think they're going to start with trying to win the games, and I think it's not crazy to think that they might be successful in doing so either. Like I do think they have a chance to be able to do so.
Yeah. I guess my bigger point is just like, I'm just saying to all my friends and family who listen to the show and who are just so angry at Billy.
The head coach's job is to win.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Win. Not only that is his job, like I do agree there are some situations where you might come in with the front office before the season starts and say, listen, this is a year for development. I think that happens.
Yeah, I think that happens.
Billy already proved he would do that in his first year as head coach when he played a rookie Patrick Williams an insane amount of minutes that he didn't deserve. That was clearly some kind of discussion with the front office that, hey, we're going to, you know, Thad Young's a better player. He should be starting, but we're going to play the young guy who just stands around and plays at half speed until he learns the game. That's the decision that was clearly made. So he's already proven to do that. I have a quote right here from Arturas. Thanks, Will Gottlieb, for posting it. We're going to try to win every game. If that's the message, don't get upset at Billy when Craig's ahead of Buzelis in rotation. I guess at the heart of it, people are just going nuts about Buzelis. Like I agree he's got talent and he showed a lot of nice flashes, but did you watch all the games? Like he was awful in the last game. He was awful at certain points of that. And that's expected because he's 19 years old. So like, I think people are vastly overrating how good he played in that summer.
He looks great. He can't shoot. YouTube clips.
Yes. Yes. There's a lot to be excited there. And there's a reason for hope. But big picture, like, come on. He's not Derrick Rose. He's not going to be in a running for rookie of the year. There's no way.
Yeah.
There's no way. Cause he's not good enough defensively or as a shooter to be in that
role. Yeah. He's probably not a future star player. I mean, maybe.
I don't know.
But it's unlikely. Maybe. It's unlikely he's going to be a future, like, star player. I think he could be a very good player, but people are pinning hope on him because they have nothing else. That's it.
So you agree, anger at coach is misplaced. I kind of agree with you. Like, I think let's just see how the first couple weeks play out. If they start out terribly, I think what we'll probably do, I hope what we do, is that we do have that meeting and say, hey, this season's about getting these young guys some burn and development. And, you know, we'll do our best to move all these guys, whether it's Zach, whether it's Craig, whether it's, you know, Vooch, who I think Vooch is unmovable. But, you know, that's another topic for another day.
I mean, I'm always excited to shit on Vooch, so I'll get us some more Apple iTunes great reviews by doing so.
Oh, yeah. Let's just a quick note on that. I want to thank everybody who's given us a good review on iTunes and Amazon. I still don't really know what it's for. I assume it's for placement when people search for the Bulls. I'll keep those up, but I shared some of those reviews with DT, and we really enjoyed them. So thank you so much. Besides the dope who gave us 1 star because we don't like Vooch, pound sand, dude. Go back to wherever you're at and put your head in the sand for an hour. I don't want to hear from you. But everybody else gave us positive reviews. Thank you.
My favorite, review is the 1 star about Vooch. Like, I don't think the reviews really matter. I don't really care. Like, anyone who wants to find us is going to find us anyway. It's not like, it's fine. It just cracks me up. The Bulls don't miss Vooch. Tell me you don't know basketball without telling me you don't know basketball. This was posted in 2024. In 2024, there's still an individual out there that thinks Vooch is a great basketball player. And that, you know, it just makes me smile about the different opinions that can exist in the world. It's probably Pauly G who left the review, to be honest, because, you know.
I hope not.
I'll narrow that down. It's Joey something or other. You know, it wasn't really Pauly. I give Pauly a hard time because, man, that guy loves himself some Vooch. Like he really does, you know. Him and Stacey. Yeah,
we all have our faults.
Could just be buddies on Vooch in the post.
Well, I did hear something on the Lockdown Bulls pod, which was a very good listen. I encourage people to check it out. I can't remember which one of the guests, and excuse me for not mentioning who it was. I don't know if it was P-Dub. But regardless, there was a great stat he had, which I kind of highlighted with my major minus. That's one of my favorite AI generated pieces of work where I have a picture of Vooch with the 9 and it says minus. I call it with the army helmet on. You ever see that, DT?
I don't know if I saw
Major
that
minus.
One,
that's my
favorite. Not bad.
you haven't seen that one? Oh, yeah, look through it. It's great. So major minus. Last 25 games, Vooch had a positive plus minus in only 7 games. In those last 25 games, for comparison's sake, Drummond had a positive plus minus in 14 of the 25 with less minutes. So, you know, he clearly faded at the end of last year. And this is a good segue to our next topic. I heard Billy talk about this in his last appearance. I heard Arturis talk about it, the importance of speeding up the game and playing at a quicker pace and taking advantage of defense that isn't set. How's that going to happen with the big anchor running, following along? What say
it's
you?
It's not. Maybe if Vooch is the guy who gets the rebound, and I do think he's a decent, you know, passer, can pass ahead quickly. He doesn't have to be the one on the run. He just has to secure and move the rebound. And maybe because he's a good defensive rebounder, you can afford to have other guys leak out earlier and be a little riskier. So maybe that would be the vision I would have on how Vooch can contribute to that. And I think that's realistic and reasonable. If you take a little bit more risk and say, you know what, your couple guards like leak out the second the shot goes up, start sprinting down the court, and, you know, just count on Vooch being back there to get the rebound and, start trying to advance the ball quickly, and he's going to make a good pass. Like that could be a way you can achieve that with the big anchor.
I would love to see that. Just see Vooch never leave the defensive paint. Just plays a continual drop defense and offense, a drop offense.
Is that different than what he does now? Like,
well, no. Now we have to, wait for him to get into the post occasionally, and everybody's screaming for free cheese and all that nonsense, and, you know, playing out of him in the high post and all this insanity. Like, it's all efficient basketball, like he's some kind of, Magic Johnson of centers.
Well,
this is the best part about getting giddy is we don't have to hear that talk about the offense needs to be run through Vooch. It's so great that talk is quieted, I think.
This is the nicest thing I've heard you say about Josh Giddey.
I'm warming up to Giddey. Let me just say this, as I've watched a lot of Giddey in the interim, and there are some, I love his rebounding. There are some things that he does that I admit I love. So he's an excellent rebounder. The more I'm watching him, I'm like, man, this guy, that's a positive. I do love how he pushes the ball when he gets the opportunity to do so. And, he's a little bit better than I thought at getting, I think, driving and getting in the lane. The issue is he just isn't drawing enough fouls and like finishing at a real high level, but I can foresee him, potentially having a really good, if he improves in that area. Even if he doesn't get that 3-point percentage up, I think there'll be value in what he brings to the court.
He's got a couple paths on offense to improve. Like, one is just his 3-point percentage gets up, and the second is that he can improve his finishing or his foul drawing. So he has a couple paths to get there, and he has a lot of the prerequisite skills that should make those paths easier, but he still has a long way to go. So the only thing I really am concerned about with Giddey, and it's even a bigger concern because of who runs our team, is the next contract. Like, I think Giddey is a legitimate NBA player, and you can find a role for him. The question is how big that role should be, whether it should be a star role or whether he's the Vooch of point guards. And, our front office is like, well, we traded for him, now we got to double down on him. And, like this is going to make you sad and cry, and me too. But it's like, how hard would it be to see Giddey putting up like a year that's like, say, 20-10-7 or something, or 27-7, right? Like, and then us giving him a max contract, and then you're just like, what the hell are you doing? What are you doing? But like, it's so easy for us to see us do that, right? Like, oh well, he's only 23 and he just put up 27-7, and there's no 27. LeBron is the only other 27-7 guy in the league, and like whatever, like and just. We're going to ignore that the efficiency is lousy and that he can't play defense and that it's really not improving the team as much as it should, and just be like, yep, max contract. Like, it's just so easy for me to see us doing something like that. And that's the part that scares me, is that we won't let the market dictate the value. And if we do let the market dictate the value, I think we'll get Giddey at a price we can tolerate. But if we give him the Pat Williams treatment of like, well, we brought him in, so now he's our guy, so now we're going to double down. You have to keep him. You can't do whatever. And we start negotiating before free agency even opens, and then we're going to end up on like a deal you hate. And I just totally think we're going to be in that boat the way our front office operates. But that's not a Giddey problem, right? That is a AK problem. That's AK's problem for operating that way. Josh Giddey is an NBA player. Like, is he going to be a star player? I don't know. Probably not. But like, he strikes me as a guy who will be a good player and a useful player. And if we pay him like a superstar, which I think we might, it's going to be a disaster. And if we pay him like the player he is, it's going to be fine.
So, like, what do you think that number is? Because, you know, that's a debate right now. I think what you have until before the season starts to extend him out. Like, what would you be happy with? I mean, me personally, I want to see him sign for like 20 million.
I wouldn't go over 20.
No player option.
I would not go over 20 in an extension right now.
Really? I'm shocked to hear you say that, DT.
Why? What would shock you about
because,
that?
Because, I mean, Quickley's making $35 million a year. I brought this up with the CHGO guys. Like, I am certain if he plays as I expect, which I think he'll put up numbers, I'm going to predict it right now, like 18-8-8.
Sign and trade him.
I think that's what the numbers will put up.
Let him walk, sign and trade
what?
Him.
What? What are you kidding
yeah.
me? why would you want to let a guy, you just sent Caruso out for him, 18-8-8, there's value in that. The guy's almost averaging a triple-double. Like, come on, what are you talking about? Well, I'm being positive on getting it, and you're telling him let him walk.
Only if he has good if he has good efficiency. Like, and I don't think he's going to. You know, I guess it's fine. I would not go above 20. I have very big concerns that Josh Giddey, through all of the other things you've mentioned, and now we're kind of flipping sides, which I like all the things you said about Josh Giddey before that were negative. Like, I think all of those are true. And I said that to you at the time. I just said there's also all these positive things. And so I think those, which you're now focused on at this moment, and I think those are all true too. And when I add those two things up, I get to like, I wouldn't pay this guy more than 20 million. Now, if he can remove some of those negative things from the equation, then that calculus changes. But I got to see that. So if we go back in time to some of our previous conversations, you had said a lot of negative things about Josh Giddey. And if you recall at that time, I said, you're right about all the negative things you said, but there's also all these positive things. And I think, you know, over time now, and you're getting a little more excited, you're now focused on those positive things, right? And I think both of them are true. Like, I think both those things are true. All the good things you just mentioned are true. All the bad things you mentioned like a month ago are true. And when I add those things up, I come to like, yeah, 20 million. Like, I'm concerned that you might not be able to play Josh Giddey in a playoff series, that he might get hunted and whatever. Like, you have to fix some of these bad things to be worth more than 20 million and to have this like consistent positive impact. It can't just be that you put up counting stats like Vucevic and then get paid. Like, you have to fix some of these flaws to have this consistent positive impact on the team. And I need to see that before I'm willing to go over 20 million. At 20 million, I'm like, yeah, you're a role player. Like, you know, if in worst case scenario, you play 25 minutes a game, you know, maybe that's not great to pay someone 20 million to do 25 minutes, but you could live with it. But if you go like 30 million, like, you're expecting this guy to throw like 32 minutes of positive impact a game in. And I'm not sure that Josh Giddey can do that. I'm not sure that he'll ever do that. Like, I think he's a viable, decent player. Like, I think he'll always be a decent player. I just don't know that he's going to be this like really big minute positive impact player. And to go above 20 million, that's what I would need to see on the floor first.
This is hilarious that right before the season, I'm becoming more positive on Josh Giddey. You're becoming more.
My view hasn't changed at all. I'm just counteracting.
It's changed a little bit.
I'm just counteracting you. But like I said, all of those negative things you said about him were true, but there was just other positive things and you shouldn't be pissed. But if you asked me how much he should make, I would have said around 20 million then too.
Okay. I'm just saying 18-8-8. Regardless of its counting stats, I understand what you're saying about the efficiency. I think there's enough there at a young age, if you're putting it up 18-8-8, that 20 million a year isn't crazy. It's definitely better than what Patrick Williams is doing for you. Like,
would you go above 20? What would you go then?
I would go right now. I tried to sign him for 20 a year.
Okay, well, you just
years.
Laughed
That's
at me for saying my ceiling
number.
Was 20, and then you just gave me the same number. So what gives?
Well,
I mean, is 20 your ceiling?
I guess you're right. Maybe I need to take a nap.
Is 20 your ceiling, or is 20 what you would try to do? What's your ceiling? What's the most you would do?
20.
Okay, so we basically agreed that like 20 million seems like.
Yeah,
I mean, like if they came and they did 25, like I wouldn't do it, but I wouldn't crucify them for it just because of what you said. Like, I think there's a fair chance you're taking a bigger gamble, and then it also offsets the chance of them paying him like 38 next offseason, which is like the real doomsday scenario,
which I think is possible. I used to think that Josh Giddey, his ceiling was completely dependent on his three-point shooting. The more I'm watching him, I think there's one other path, which is the what I call the Luka path. If he gets stronger, he's not strong enough now, but if somehow he really dedicates himself and really works on getting stronger, like Luka is so good in the paint, using his body to create space, you know, passing out of that. That's where I think he really shines, and I didn't expect him to have such ease and to do it with such ease. I'm not saying that Giddey's ever going to get there, but he's not terrible when he gets in the paint. Like, I kind of feel like there might be an option for him, if he gets stronger and bigger, for him to be that guy who gets in the paint, manipulates the plays like Luka does, obviously a poor man's version of that, and becomes effective in doing so, because he is a good passer. So, and he does have to finish better, but I think that comes along with getting stronger. He's just not strong enough. I've watched a lot of games of his all, you know, over the last couple of weeks, and I'm like, that's to me his biggest thing. For his size, he needs to be a little bit tougher, physically stronger. I don't think he's ever going to be an uber athlete. He's never going to be super, but he's not slow. That's the other thing. He's pretty quick. I don't know. I've kind of warmed on him definitely lately. What's
quick with the ball. So it's like one of the things I think I always use Steve Nash as the perfect example of this to me. Like Steve Nash in his prime, like I don't know if any of us would say Steve Nash is like an elite athlete. Like probably not, right?
Not elite, but he's a good athlete, I would say.
Steve Nash could get in the paint anytime he wanted. And the reason he could do that was not because he had this amazing first step and blew people away with his athleticism. It was because he had amazing control of the ball. And Giddey is a guy, maybe not Steve Nash level with the ball, but he's quick with the ball. Like he can move quickly with the ball and take a first step. Like no matter how athletic someone is, if you're not allowed to put your hands on me and grab me and stop me, if I'm not having to dribble a basketball, I could get around you, right? Like you're not allowed to grab me. Like the reason I can't do that well is because I have to do that while dribbling a basketball and have you not knock the basketball away. And so people who are really good at handling the ball can just get into the paint even if they don't have this amazing athleticism. And so I think Josh Giddey has that potential. I do think I've not considered the strength thing that you mentioned, but I agree with you. When you bring it up, like it's an interesting thought. Like I'd say Giddey is probably the difference between him and Luka is like probably 30 pounds of muscle. And that's a lot.
Or fat.
Well, a little bit of fat too. Maybe 20 pounds of muscle and 10 pounds of fat. But I mean, like there's a lot of
Luka looks like a guy just shows up at a bar sometimes. And he needs to get serious about getting in shape. Love Luka.
You only think that because he's standing next to a bunch of guys with our like 3% body fat. Like if you, me and Luka were sitting next to each other, like Luka would look like an Adonis. Like, I mean, like, let's be realistic here. He's probably right. like eight or 9% body fat.
A lot of people though.
Looks really fat in the NBA. But like, it would be like my dream to get that thin. So anyway, but Josh Giddey, I think the greater point though is like, I think he would need to add a lot of muscle for that to happen, but it would be interesting. It would be interesting if he took that approach or tried it or was successful because, yeah, if he was able to like fight through contact a lot better, that would really open up the foul drawing possibility that you mentioned earlier.
But, you know, like if they don't sign him before this camp, like I keep on going to Quickley. Like Josh Giddey is a better basketball player than Emmanuel Quickley. Quickley's a better defender.
I don't know.
I think Josh Giddey's better offensively than Quickley. You don't agree with that? I feel that way. I think brought this up with Chinowski, Mark Chinowski. I think I'd rather have Giddey than Quickley. He's bigger. I just think he's got more upside. If he has 18.88, he's going to cost $30 million, Doug. At least Quickley's making $35 million a year. So my point is like, all right, you didn't get aggressive and try to sign him, and you let a year go by. It cost you $10 million. This Patrick Williams negotiation cost you $3 to $5 million. That's $13 to $15 million in a new NBA with a hard cap at the second apron. That's massive.
We have a hard cap
for the next 4 years.
Let's be serious here.
You're right. Good point. Good point. Hard cap. Good counter. That's a fantastic counter with a hard.
Come on.
With a hard cap at the first apron. You're right. Exactly right. But that said. Do you see what I mean? Like it's when you add up all these
Do you know what Emmanuel Quickley did last year? Here's his numbers on the Raptors last year. 18.6 points a game, 6.8 assists a game, 4.8 rebounds, only 1.8 turnovers, shot 39.5% from three on 7 attempts a game, and he's a fantastic defender. Come on. Josh
that is Giddey pretty good. Right, maybe you're right.
Come on.
What were his numbers though for the whole year? That's a limited
for the whole
sample
year,
size. He didn't get
17 points a game, 4.9 assists. He had a lot less assists with the Knicks, just in a different role. 3.6 rebounds, still 39.5% from three.
Jeez, how did I miss he was shooting that well from three? What's his career percentage from three?
Career 37.5.
Holy cow. I take it all back. Quickly's better than Giddey. I'm shocked he's a 40% three-point shooter. That's freaking great. And he is a good defender. But he's not, how tall big is he, 6'2"?
I don't know.
Maybe I'm off on that.
Something like that. He strikes me as short.
Don't look it up.
I had the page open. I didn't have his all his stats memorized. Just had to scroll a little bit.
What are his hobbies, Doug? What are his hobbies and what's his sign?
I can tell you his, all right. Yeah, his Twitter is IQ Godson, so I guess.
I'm feeling more positive about the beloved bowl. I heard our mutual friend, Big Dave, and I agree with this. He said he thinks this bowl team is going to be fun bad, quote unquote fun bad. I agree. I am freaking excited about seeing Coby White and seeing Giddey and seeing Zach and seeing what these guys can do offensively, even Io. I agree. Everything else is going to be a mess in the defensive end. I've kind of come to that resignation, but everything else is going to be freaking great.
I think it is going to be fun bad. I think that's true. And I think there's a chance that it's going to be fun mediocre. You know, I think there's a chance that they could still be a play-in team this year. I think they're probably going to be around a 30 win team, low 30s, but it's not way outside the margin of error that they win 39 games and basically have an identical season to last year, except they're way more fun to watch and that the talent is younger and you feel like this team could grow and get better. I don't know that I'm super amped, but I do think it's going to be a more enjoyable product than we had last year. And there's going to be a lot of wow moments with Josh Giddey in the game that you just didn't have last year because you didn't have someone who was this really visionary passer. And so Giddey is going to create a lot of really cool, fun highlights. And that'll be more fun. It's more exciting to watch. May not result in more wins, but it's going to be more exciting to watch.
I tell you, fun bad sounds a lot better to me than fun mediocre.
It's hilarious because mediocre is still better than bad, but yes, you're right. Fun bad does sound better than fun mediocre. So we got to rebrand fun mediocre. Fun average? That still doesn't sound great. Fun bad almost kind of sounds a little more positive somehow.
I think that would be the best of all worlds, that this team has a lot of young players that show growth this year, and we win 25 games. All right, last question, and we'll wrap this baby up. I get into a time machine. I go out to June of 2025. I see with the Bulls how many wins they had for this upcoming season. I come back and I tell you, you got to pick. They won 25 or 38 games. What do you bet on?
Ooh, I think both of those are outside what I would predict by a good margin. I guess I would say the downside is more likely than the upside, but I'd say it's a toss up. Like I said, I would pick 32 as my number. I guess 38 technically is closer to the 32. What the hell? I'll go 38.
I say 25. There's no way this team's winning 38 games. The East is too good. The West is too good.
I don't think they're going to win 25 games either, though.
30 games against the West.
I agree with you that they're not going to win 38 games, most likely. I just don't think they're going to win 25 either.
Okay. I hope I'm wrong. I mean, how great would it be? Well, I don't know how great it would be if they won 39 games, 38 games. 11th spot.
The Spurs. I know people think that's this doomsday scenario, but I don't really think that's true either. So I'm
Doug. What happens if this year they pick 11th and next year they pick 14th? How would that make you feel?
Well, what would matter if they pick 11th this year? They gave it to the Spurs. What is the significance of any of 14th next year?
Well, that's my point. That's to me a worst case scenario that you're still in the lottery 2 years. You give one of your lottery picks away.
Yeah, I mean,
what are we doing?
I don't know. I don't know that if we are just really bad that it's gonna. You got to figure out a way to get good, it's kind of we talked about, are you really aiming as the draft as your solution? And that's it with one single pick, the 2025 pick is it? Okay. Say we pick seventh and the guy we pick sucks. Say we pick the next Patrick Williams. Are we any better off? Would I rather pick seventh this year and seventh again in 2026 and then seventh again in 2027? Or would I rather pick 11th and 14th? If your whole hope is that getting one pick this year is going to save the franchise, I just think that's a really dim hope.
I think the fallacy in your argument about, I've heard you say this, I've heard some other people say, hey, 2026 draft is just as good as this draft. And I'm that's great if we all live forever.
I didn't say
but we
2026
don't.
Is just
we lose
as
a
good.
Year.
I just said, if you aren't picking one of the top few superstars, you shouldn't predict that 2025's draft is going to be meaningful.
I want Cooper Flagg. The best way to do that is to get 25 wins. Like I don't
Okay, we've got a 14% chance of it if we get like 20 wins.
That's 14 more percent chances than if we finish as the AC. You know, like that's what I want. That's what I want. Fine. Let's do it. Maybe we can trade Patrick Williams for the number one pick. Let's see how he plays this year. If he's even ready for the season. You hear he had a setback?
How do you feel about that? Not talk about that?
Yeah, let's talk about that and then we'll bring in the bus. As my foot hurts as I put it on the pedal. What is the odds that he ends up playing this year?
I think this is low-key a disaster. Like, so one, it just makes the negotiation so much dumber. Like, all right, I looked this up just to, you know, to try and figure out, like, am I crazy about this? So I looked it up. He had a surgery, I believe it was on March 8th, as best as I could tell. I couldn't find anything that said, like, he had the surgery today, but I found something that was anticipated to be that day. But they were trying to move it earlier. So, like, March 8th or earlier. At the time, they said his recovery will be 4 months long. So that is July 8th for those counting at home. This is expected recovery time. Around that period of time, it's reported by Casey Johnson that he's like jumping and sprinting and doing everything, right? And like stuff seems good. And now we're like a month before the season. And it's like, all right, we go to an organized practice. And it's like he had to rest. You know, he had to like sit out extra time. And so to some part, it would be like...
At the Miami minicamp.
And so this, for some part, it was like kind of like if you just said, hey, he's doing normal progression, you know, he's still taking some breaks. This is normal. That'll be fine. But that's not the way it was phrased. And so maybe this is just a poor way it was phrased and it's nothing. But he's still experiencing discomfort in his foot. Doesn't feel like he's still ramping up. It feels like this problem still exists. Now, take that information. Go look up bone edema and the recovery times and the bumps and hurdles along the way. And it's like, yeah, anywhere from 6 months to 2 years for recovery. This is what Lonzo Ball had in his knee that kept him out for 2.5 years and had him making experimental procedures to try to get better. This is not a great situation. Like, it would not surprise me if this is just an absolute disaster. Like, so we are like now 7 months into a thing that should have been recovered in 4 months. And we've got 1 month left before the season starts, less than 1 month before the season starts. Like, to think he's going to be ready to go and then fully ready, that just strikes me as like not so much. Which means, to your point earlier, Modest is going to play plenty. And so is Torrey Craig.
Maybe. I still think it's possible that Modest doesn't play at all. And they just go, he's going to play a three-guard lineup, which I'm
Javon
fine with.
Javon Carter is going to start
Dale
a power
Terry. Ahead of him. Oh, don't even say it. I will say one more thing about this, you know, Patrick Williams. It was brought up right away. You know, like the question came up. These are football guys on the score, of course, so they don't have any follow-up questions. Like the first follow-up question I would have wanted, hey, if you want to play faster, how's that going to work with arguably the slowest center or plotting center in the league running around? They didn't even follow up with that. But, you know, they brought up Patrick Williams, and right away, you got Arturis jumping in saying, well, really, he's only really played 2 years when you figure out he's missed a couple years. And I'm like, dude, he started last season. He played the first 2 months of last season, and he played so bad when he was healthy that he lost his starting job after we started out, you know, 5-10 or whatever, Torrey Craig. So, like, what are you talking about? Like, don't act like he didn't play at all in those years. Yeah, he finished the year hurt, but he still played. We're going into his year five here. Come on, man. You're going to use that excuse? He's willing to play 2 years? Give me a break, dude. Yeah. And then my other point was, I always hear this too. Well, we had to sign him because we could have lost him to the Hornets or Pistons. You know, and I looked it up. I brought this up on a CHGO show. You know how many contracts, restricted free agent contracts to other teams the Hornets have gone after in the last 10 years, Doug? You want to take a guess?
I guess zero.
One. 2014, they tried to sign Gordon Hayward, who was with the Utah Jazz at the time. They offered Hayward a 4-year, $63 million contract, and the Jazz matched it. So he stayed in Utah. And then the Pistons, how many times last 10 years? They did it twice. Allen Crabb, 2016, and Narlens Noel in 2018. Like, there was zero chance those two teams were going to offer $25 million a year for Patrick Williams when they have guys, young players on their roster who are going to require maximum contracts in the next few years. It is the dumbest argument. I just can't even believe it. You know, like that you think that you were in a position of strength because of that. Oh, my God.
Well, you know, 100% of team pregnancies end at the age of 20.
Took me a minute to confirm that, but you're absolutely correct on that assertion.
Just like one of those like nonsensical stats or like arguments people bring up, like what are we talking about here?
That's a very good stat. I'm gonna start going around.
Just like every time someone says something that they just try to use a statistic to say something that's meaningless. I just like to throw that one out there. Yeah, I there was no reason not to play hardball with Pat Williams. Did Detroit go after Isaac Okoro? Did Charlotte go after him? Did they go after like Obi Toppin? Like, you know, what are we talking about here? Like they were like they didn't go after any of these other guys. It was only your guy, who seems like, you know, I posted this on Twitter, and I think you're a huge Toppin fan generally, right? I'm not like being crazy. You like Obi Toppin?
Yeah, I wouldn't say huge, but whatever. But I'd rather have him than one.
Sorry, I was thinking Isaac Okoro. I said Obi Toppin, but I was thinking Okoro. You're a big Okoro fan.
Huge.
Yeah. And so,
yes, I love him.
I also like Okoro, and I'd say if I had to choose between Okoro and Patrick Williams, I'd probably take Okoro. You know, if I could ignore the health things, I would say it's like pretty close, but I would probably take Okoro with the health things. It's not even a discussion. And so, you know, like the Cavs played hardball, and you know, they got Okoro on like a 339 deal. And you know, like why did you think like, you know, your guy was like so much better than these other two options, which were like, you know, like somewhere between similar tiers, I would say. Like, I'd say those three guys are like similar tier players. And, you know, we paid way more for our guy than those other teams paid for their guy. And the idea that like if Detroit or Charlotte want a guy that they were going to like overbid on just our guy just seems like just a weird fallacy to have in your head. And it, like I said, it just comes down to these guys double down on all the moves they make, and they do it early. It's like the same with the Vooch extension. Like maybe you wanted to keep Vooch. Why did you think you had to do that before the season started? Like you really thought like you couldn't like be like, hey, Vooch, $15 million a year. Let's see if someone else trumps that. Like no one else is going to. And, you know, he's not worth $15 million a year either, but you'd sure be happier about his deal if it was $15 million instead of $20 million. So, you know, it's like some of these things, like they just, their process is bad for the way they behave and make decisions.
I know some people might say, well, the Cavs had to play hardball because they have so many good players that are making so much money. They just couldn't, they have a legitimate problem with the second apron. So, like, they didn't have a choice. They had to play hardball. Fair enough. They still played hardball.
Yeah, well, like,
and they also realized, too, that the presence of, like, if anything, the presence of Okoro on the free agent market should have been another reason for the Bulls to basically use the hammer, use the RFA to say, listen, we're not giving you a player option. We're going to take a team option in year five, and we're going to give you $16 million a year or $17 million a year. And you just look at the two organizations, it's just like night and day. And it's insane to me that they got him for $6 million less a year on 3 years. Yeah, that's the advantage to Okoro, is he can become a free agent in 3 years, I guess. But, I mean, regardless, you're still getting him for $6 million less a year than Williams. And nobody in their right mind would ever say, I'd rather have him for $3 million, $6 million more. They're very similar players. You know, obviously, Williams is a little bit bigger, but, you know, Okoro's definitely more aggressive. And, you know, nowadays he's shooting a three at a high level. It's like, to me, he's a superior player.
Yeah, I just think it's nuts with the injury, too. Like, they just seem like they just didn't take that into consideration at all. And that just seems like a weird, weird thing not to think about.
Agreed. Agreed, DT. All right, well, let's bring the Big Red Bus in, man. Great show. Fantastic discussion. I loved it. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, I mean, we're amazing.
I guess so. But next time, we're going to have actual basketball to discuss. And I can't wait, my brother. All right, man.
Next time. Go Bulls.
Take it easy, buddy. Talk to you later, DT. And until next time.
Go Bulls.
Yes. Go Bulls. Take it easy, brother.